Well, let's wait like all professionals do. How's everyone's morning going?
Good.
All right, raise your hand if you got a hangover. Yay. Why the fuck are the people with the hangover in the front row? Do you have any idea how loud I am?
Oh, okay, okay.
I am a headache incarnate.
It's sweet talk right now. So, in California, I'm used to a gummy being 5 or 10. And somebody hands me a gummy and I eat it, and I didn't look at the packaging. It was a 50. So I flew here.
You went on Mr. Toad's wild ride. You're used to a 10 and you 50 just
like half a 10. I'll do half.
Oh, honey. I gotta know, because I know what it does to me when I go too far. Did you go crazy or did you go to sleep?
You were on Mars, laying in your bed.
Okay.
Laying in bed, there it is! That's the best part. You go too far, it's just like, the only thing I can do right now is bed. And all of your friends go...
it's amazing. The Pink Floyd video suddenly makes so much sense.
Yeah, Pink Floyd is so much better.
Oh! That's fine.
Oh, wonderful. Well, JT shows up. We have her. So we actually do have some variety.
Do we, though?
Yeah, we've got you, and me, and then we've got Buddy down on the end. We'll talk about a myriad of careers they've been involved with. We have Ferb, undeniably the most interesting of all of us.
Yes.
And the guy who crashed the economic system.
Only in Sweden once.
True story.
True story.
So yeah, we got enough variety. Between all of our backgrounds, we have enough variety.
Yeah, I do actually.
Good morning. You slept last night. Why do you look so exhausted?
I went to sleep last night. People use my room for very strange things at this con.
Only at this con.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Rear Professionals, or as it's better known, welcome to the panel that shows you didn't get invited to a room party last night. It is 11 a.m. on a Saturday. Let's just all be very clear. If we there, none of us ran a room party last night. We asked to go, and they said no. I am the Boozy Badger. Before we go, I'll give you my bona fides. I am a litigation and trial attorney in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I'm licensed within the Commonwealth to practice in front of all courts, the Eastern District, the Middle District, the Western District, the Third Circuit, not the United States Supreme Court, although we have one of those up here. After about a decade in private practice, I moved over to work as a government litigation attorney just in this last year. So I'm more than willing to talk about both of those. Seated to my right over here. Turn on the mic. Yeah.
It's on. Good morning. I am Hap Shepherd, or Habeas Barcus is my full name, and I work with this one, if you can believe that.
I'm sorry.
We went to law school together. I was a public defender for about 4.5 years in one of the eastern counties in Pennsylvania. And then I started as a government attorney about 3.5 years ago, and we had some openings in our office, and I told this one, hey, come work for us. And so now we're working together. We can almost throw things at each other.
Yeah. Not a joke, by the way. Our offices are directly across the hall from each other.
It's really great talking about work things and being like, ooh, did you hear the latest thing on Twitter?
Yeah. He walks into my office and I'm like, so let's file the preliminary objections to the board of view, and we're going to need a brief for that. It's in this county, and you hear about Peace Wolf?
Hold on. Are your guys' offices literally across
yes.
each
yes.
other? I'm buying you throwing dildos for Christmas.
Our boss would like
the deputy chief's office is between our two offices. So I can just see our boss looking up the window in her office and just a dildo flies across.
I'm sorry, hold on. This panel is called We're Professionals. We are all friends in a professional capacity. Since when do the gags on each other have anything to do with our bosses? That's just incentive to send you the dildos.
To my left, that's you.
Oh!
Left, right. You know, because the left hand...
You know what I do in your ass. Hi, my name is Alkali. I was in the commodities industry for over 20 years of my life, starting in the brokerage pits and moving up to an office. And finally, I realized that I was done getting rich people richer, and now I am a professional comedian and podcaster. In quotes.
Going back over to the right.
Hi, I'm Cody. I am a trial attorney from Maryland. I work in private practice right now. Ooh. I've done everything from working for the court system to being the opposite of him, a state's attorney in Maryland. I currently do family law, personal injury, you name it. If it pays, I do it.
Guys.
Back over here. That's you, creature. That's you.
Oh, L.
Hi, I'm Fur. I'm an AV automation integrator for large theme parks and corporate installations. I do things that have budgets in the tens and twenties of millions of dollars. Before that, I was working in the broadcast industry. Some of my credits include My Little Pony Friendship is Magic, The Aquabats Super Show, Saints Row 3 and 4, and I also won at Little Tony for a thing called American Idiot on Broadway.
The wrong fucking industry.
Yeah.
Like, I love it. By the way, just want to point out, I saw your pitch, like, they got, like, one stockbroker and a bunch of others. I'm like, fuck you, we got a Tony-winning artist. Next to Fur.
Hi, I'm JT Wolf. I am in government communications and public relations for one of the New England states. It's not really that hard to figure out which one. But there are some alt-right bloggers who might want to tear my life up, so I'm going to keep a little veil of anonymity. And for some reason, I decided to wear, like, a full suit to this because I thought it would be funny. Which is about the level of, like, English degree that I have.
JT, perfectly fine, because I actually have my three-piece sitting in my room, and I've got it out to put it on, and then I opened it up, and the vest is just covered with cat hair, so we're like, yeah, no, we need to get a lint roller before I wear my vest.
You should just go to court next week, and the judge asks.
Yeah, Judge Cody.
I have cats.
I got a room full. Can you say not guilty to this kid?
Depends, do I feel like I know what I'm doing?
And finally, all the way on the end.
Hi, I'm Buddy Goodboy. I'm currently a research attorney. I help develop software for other attorneys to use in their research. I have been, in various points of my career, a school teacher. I've cleaned bathrooms on a professional level. I have done bankruptcy law. I was an in-house attorney for a medical practice right at the start of COVID, and did that for 3 years. That was an interesting period of my life, and right now, my work-life balance is way better than it's ever been, hence me being here.
Which actually brings up a good question, because normally the way we do this, first of all, that we're professionals, we're not employed by you. So nothing that we're going to respond today, especially for the attorneys, is going to create any type of legal advice, attorney-client privilege, attorney-client relationship. When we talk about things, we're going to change, especially for the attorneys, we're going to change some of the facts. The gist is true. The story of the details may not be. Why? Because we have confidentiality requirements in our job just by virtue of our job. That means we have to omit details, revise details. We have to make it so nothing can be identifiable to anything to do with our work. All right? That said, when we do open it up for questions from, because we are, a lot of this is we're going to let you all ask questions and then we're going to ramble a response to you and act like you answered your question. Whether it did or not, we don't care. But we're going to figure out a way to respond. When it comes to financial advice, please do not ask Alkali for financial advice. He can't answer you. Comes to legal advice. Don't ask us for legal advice. Number one, you have just waived any privilege you will ever have regarding the thing you've asked about when you do finally get an attorney because you've asked in front of a room full of people. Number two, we cannot give legal advice to you. We're not your attorneys. Do not say hypothetically.
I have a friend. Let's call him
Yeah. No. I'm asking for a friend. Hypothetically, no. We know you don't have a friend.
You didn't go to the room party.
We also know none of this is taking place in Minecraft. Yeah. I'll try that.
We are lawyers. It is our professional responsibility to smell bullshit like a fat kid smells cake. So I get to say that.
Excuse me. I like cake too.
Yeah, I know.
How dare you, skinny son of a bitch?
That's
our cake! You can't just take
her! That's it. Actually, Buddy brings up a good question right off the bat, going through that list of it. Outside of the profession you're up here for, what other jobs have you all had?
Are you asking all of us?
All of us.
I was a lifeguard for 7 summers. I worked at a small town beer distributor delivering beer and ice, making ice, and various other jobs like that.
I started working as a journalist about 2 months before Trump went down the elevator. So, and I did that for about 75% of the Trump presidency. So you can imagine how that degraded over time.
Pizzeria. I worked at a pizzeria near the college I went to, so I fed drunk kids.
Fur?
Oh, dear God.
My dad had a boat. It was like one of those,
amazing sentences.
What a great
It was one of those, like 40-foot, like, you know, like, not yacht level, but still, you know, really nice boats. Some guy died, and he just, like, got it.
Is your dad a pirate?
Technically, yes. But my dad would, he chartered this boat out, and then he realized that if he put a little checkbox on the form for an extra $200, he would pretend the boat is yours. Now, you might think that's a weird little gimmick, but imagine you're like a mid-level executive really trying to impress the president, and you're like, oh yeah, we'll come out on my yacht, we'll discuss things over lunch, and we'll go do a sunset cruise. I'll have my captain prepare it. And I was the first mate. And I would be like, oh, welcome back, you know, I hope you enjoy your time. How was, you know, blank, 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 you know, wherever you were at. And the best part about the grift was that people got stuck. They went, oh, let me go back out on your boat.
Well, Fear, the next question is, can we go back on the boat?
What the hell?
Can we turn the lights on?
That's probably a good thing. It's early. My first job was shoveling shit.
Yeah.
Still is.
Never stop.
I worked for a guy who had, he owned produce stands, and he had made a deal with the dairy farmers in the state that he would muck out their stalls, and then he would take this load of manure back to his stores with a load of clean-filled dirt that he had gotten, and he would mix them together into burlap sacks to sell as fertilizer. And my first job was shoveling the shit from the manure pile to mix it with the dirt and then shove it into the burlap sack.
God damn.
So I've done, I've shoveled shit. Still do. I've been a merchant marine on the Western Rivers, bartender, taxi driver, third shift donut baker, laser tag referee, grocery store clerk, insurance adjuster.
Oh.
I was an insurance adjuster.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
For a health insurance company.
Used car salesman.
I was a used car salesman.
Does not surprise me. Does not surprise me.
I've done a lot of shit.
Yeah.
That said, anybody have a question? Yes.
So, like, what's typically the minimum GPA you need to get into law
school? Next question. Every law school sets its own admission standards. like below a B, below a 3.0, you're not going to get into a decent law school. But every law school does have exceptions as well. Part of the admissions process is you write like an essay and you take the LSAT and you have your GPA and they'll look at like a curriculum vitae and you have people write recommendation letters for you. And there were people I know in our law school that had below a 3.0 that got in based on the strength of their essay, their LSAT, and their resume letters. You know, people who like, you know, I didn't do that great in college, but it's because my mother died and I had to raise all four of my younger siblings at once while working 45 hours a week between classes. And somebody in the admissions office would go like, I'll say it's good, and that's a pretty goddamn compelling story. Let's admit them. Do they get a scholarship? No, but. So there really isn't one, but the rule of thumb is you probably want about a 3.0, and even then you're going to want a decently high LSAT, I would say. What was your experience with taking the LSAT?
So I took a prep class and actually did worse than my practice tests. Yeah, the actual LSAT.
Oh my god!
So here's the thing: everything you need to learn for law school, everything you need to learn for the LSAT, you don't need for law school. Everything you learn in law school, you don't need for the bar. And everything you need to memorize for a closed book exam and the bar exam doesn't actually apply in the real world because you can just ask your entire office, "Hey, how do I do this?" Yeah.
What about your? What was your LSAT experience?
Miserable. I don't test very well, so.
But the LSAT is the Legal Scholastic Aptitude Test, and it is like it's not like the SAT with like a math section and a reading. It is all reading comprehension, problem application, and logic puzzles.
So you remember those problems of if a train leaves the station at 3:15 going for it's worse.
Yeah, like there's
hold on. It's that's my favorite.
I don't care that you're a mathematician.
There's a section of the LSAT that we just call the logic games, and what it's like. You know, Bob, Timmy, Sue, and Mary all have cars. The cars are red, green, blue, black, and silver. Bob only drives on Monday, and they only drive each car one day a week. If Bob drives a green car, but Mary only drives on Thursdays, and the green car never drives on Fridays, who owns? And that's the logic portion of it. And the idea is that it's not testing illegal knowledge. That's how I'll hear people like, I'm going to take the LSAT, so I've got this law book. And I'm like, nothing legal on the LSAT. Not a single legal question, because the idea is it's testing your analytical mind and your logic application, and that's it. It's the things that they think make a good lawyer. Buddy, what was your experience with the LSAT?
Took a practice test cold. I spent an entire summer taking 10 practice exams, doing a study course, and I wound up doing exactly the same.
An entire summer, several practice tests.
I took a course. I mean, but I'm a really, like, my parents, when they heard I passed the bar, said, we didn't think you'd pass it.
Damn. You know how many practice courses I took?
Zero.
Yeah. You know how many reading, how much reading I did?
Zero.
You know how many practice tests I took?
I need to remind you I do work across the hall?
Rolling dildo!
It's coming.
Honestly, though, I was a non-traditional law student. When I graduated college, I immediately went to work in insurance at the time because I had just had two babies. I mean, like, I didn't have them. They were mine. I drove the lumber to the work site. Someone else built the house. So I went to work in insurance, and I was working on a master's in antebellum American history, specifically the migration of the German Palatine immigrants through the southern Appalachian mountain range from 1830 to 1850 was my primary area of focus of study at that time. And a history professor, actually from Pittsburgh, because I was minoring in the dissolution of the socio-political influences of the dissolution of the Soviet Union from 1990 to 1993, and I had a wonderful visiting professor from Pitt who was down there doing that, was advising me on it. He sent me down to his office one day and he said, I read your thesis, it's wonderful, and you should be a lawyer because you will be poor in academia. So my father's an attorney, and I decided before I spend money on all these practice courses, I'm going to take the LSAT. I'm going to find out going in cold what my score is. Because at that point in time, it was just your highest LSAT score from the last three tests went. I think now they're like, the schools can see. But now, then it was just your highest one was the only one they used.
Which one is it, Mr. Ryler? Yeah.
Oh, I never took the LSAT. I got in with my GRE.
That was, you see, when we
second.
That's something else they've started doing. Schools will now take the GRE. When we went, they did. The GRE.
What is this nonsense?
Yeah, the GRE is a graduate school exam.
Go Toro.
So I took the LSAT cold, figuring I'd get my score, that'd give me a good baseline, I'd know where I needed to be and how much work I need to put in. And I thought, yeah, I had no intention of applying. It was just going to go in. So I just showed up with all these, like, nervous college seniors. Like, oh, God. And I'm, like, walking in and, like, sweatpants with a hole in the crotch. Haven't shaved. Got sunglasses on. Sip a beer out of coffee cup. Like, yeah, let's do this. Right?
Not much changed in law school.
Yeah. I scored a 172.
Out of?
180. And this actually goes to your GPA question as well, because my GPA at that point, because I fucked around my first year of undergrad, really my second year too, my GPA was only like a 3.2, which for law school is not an amazing GPA, but the 172 was good. And my law school ended up offering me a scholarship as a result to get us to go there to pump it up. So there's a lot of factors that go into it than just the GPA. A good LSAT, a good life experience. URM, we call them underrepresented minorities. URM is kind of a mandate for law schools to try to increase the number of underrepresented groups in the practice of law. So that will help on that. GPA is not the end-all be-all, but you want at least a 3.0 if you're going to have a really good LSAT score with it.
And sweats with a hole in the crotch.
And if you're hearing everything that you need to go through to get to the admission process in law school, I usually recommend college students and tell me they want to be a lawyer to try to see if they can get some experience in a law office first.
Definitely.
Just to make sure you actually like it, because before you know it, you're going to be $50,000 in, and that's not necessarily the time where you want to sit there and go, oh, I don't want to do this.
That was like, when I say a professor told me to be a lawyer, so I did it. I left out the part where my father's been an attorney for 45 years, and I grew up working in his office, so I knew exactly what that entailed and what the practice of law was about.
It's nothing like what most people think it is. It is nothing like you see on TV.
Yeah. Yes, right back there.
Jumping off of that point, is there anywhere in the country that still goes the very traditional route and allows people who just read law to
read
take
law.
The bar?
Actually, yeah.
Wisconsin?
What we're talking about, for a long period of time, the method of being admitted to the bar, you didn't go to a law school. Like, it's always been an option to go to a law school. Right? Like, the oldest law school in the U.S. is from, like, the early 1800s. But the traditional method of learning law, qualifying to be a lawyer, was you would go in, you would find a lawyer that was willing to mentor you. Often you'd pay them to mentor you. And when they thought you were ready, that you would stand before the bar. And the bar would be a panel of judges and lawyers, and they would question you. It was like a dissertation defense. Is anybody familiar with that? Where you write a dissertation, and then you go in front of a panel of experts in the subject matter, and they drill you on your dissertation, right? That's what taking the bar used to be. It used to be an oral examination given by a panel of attorneys, once your mentor would, we called it stand for you at the bar, standing for you would be to stand and suggest that you be admitted to the bar. That changed, and they started going to law school, and then the written bar exam route. As a matter of fact, I actually knew the last attorney in the Commonwealth of Kentucky to be admitted on oral examination. He was a mean son of a bitch. 90 years old, two canes, and hated human beings. But to answer, are there places that still do that? Yeah, California is the biggest example. There's like
Wisconsin, I find?
Yeah, Wisconsin does it too?
I think.
Yeah.
West Virginia.
West Virginia.
Virginia does.
Virginia still does.
New York, you have to be working for an attorney for 4 years full time as an apprentice or intern, and then you can just test.
Yeah. So the answer is yes. There are states that do allow you to still read law.
Thank you.
Zapatos picks up on.
Don't know the end.
I'm going to take this to you right off the bat. We've got the lawyer answers. I want to hear the non-lawyers.
I was going to say, legally, I don't think we can even talk about that.
Yeah, I'm sure you can.
I have a good one.
Please do.
The White House accidentally invited me to meet Kamala Harris.
Oh.
And then it turned out that the invitation was meant for someone about five levels of seniority above me. And my response to this information was, can I still go? And they said, you are a lowly plebeian. You do not get to meet the vice president. But you may sit in the room as a good Democrat and observe her. I'll take it. I parlayed it. I mean, it was a fun experience. I got patted down by Secret Service for the first time. It was legitimately important being in the room, listening to the vice president talk about reproductive rights. And then I took a wrong turn when I was leaving and sat on the highway for 45 minutes in standstill traffic while her motorcade went back to the airport. Good stuff, government.
Oh, my God. All right.
Yes, over there. Yes, you. You with the glasses.
Hi.
Hi.
So I actually was recently hired as a matter intake coordinator for a law firm. Thank you. I used to be a librarian. I got laid off twice. Don't become a librarian, anyone who is considering that career.
Don't become a lawyer either. But.
What's a matter intake specialist? We don't have one.
So when people bring cases forward, I have to check and see if there's any conflicts. I guess what I was wondering, based on this panel, it appears to be likely that there is a non-zero number of secret furry lawyers at my firm.
Would you like a bag of throwing dildos? They'll all come out of the woodwork, trust me.
But I'm very curious, what are the signs I'm looking for?
Okay. Do you have, like, a group chat channel? Like, you use Teams or Slack or something?
I believe we use Teams.
Okay, so on Teams, you have the ability to reply with GIFs.
Okay.
Start with the easy ones. Bluey, maybe a Zootopia one or two after you feel a little bit comfortable.
This is fine. The dog.
Yeah, the dog. This is fine.
That's classic. Every office knows this is fine.
Wait to see who responds to that with a heart. Keep an eye on them.
I love your imagery there. It's like, you know, the box with the stick holding it up, and they're hiding there with a little string. They just got a got it. I'm glad you picked one.
Let's go right here, blue shirt.
Me?
Yes.
That's gray.
Is that gray?
Yeah.
Oh, fuck me!
You're doing great, sweetie.
You're colorblind.
Sorry.
He's a...
So this is for both lawyers and non-lawyers. Has there ever been like a case like that's just made you go, yeah, this is why I became a lawyer, or...
Oh, that's an interesting one. Okay.
Like, something where it's like, keep your money. The bone I got from the justice...
There has never been a case where my response at the end of it has been, keep your money. Like, I've had people contact me like, thank you so much. We would have been really bad off if we hadn't hired you, if you hadn't done this, or the whole family's really grateful for what you did, and they're shaking my hand. They're like, you know, I had a couple, and I saved their home. I saved their lifelong home. I kept them in it. I took care of their debts. I got the bank and the IRS off their backs, and they brought me this wonderful basket filled with imported chocolates and a card and wept profusely as they thanked me and handed me that. And I said, oh, thank you so much. It was no problem. By the way, here's your invoice. It is payable in 30 days or less.
I handle adoptions, so, you know, I get to put families together when I'm not busy handling divorces and tearing them apart.
So I have a serious answer and a funny answer. The serious answer is, I guess in my public defender career, I had many, many clients who were, they were charged with drug crimes, you know, it was all possession, and a lot of them. Addiction's a real thing, and I had clients that I would get them on probation and say, oh, thank you, I'll never see you again, and I'm thinking, I'm going to see you in about 3 months. And, you know, sure enough, you know, some of these people I'd see, and I distinctly remember one client. Our county had what's called a drug court, which is a diversionary program for people that are facing state prison charges. And he had two or three kids, but was absolutely begging me, please get me into drug court. And I knew he needed it, and I knew he deserved it, so I fought really hard for him to get it. And he ended up getting in, and I saw him on the street one day, and I couldn't remember his name, but he came up and was thanking me profusely for helping him. I got to do my funny.
Okay, that was your funny one?
No. Okay. So my funny one is, I had a really bad client as a public defender who ended up going to trial and ended up losing the trial. It was a really bad case, but ended up having to take an appeal to Superior Court and actually made case law in Pennsylvania within 5 years of being an attorney. And so the best part was when that case screwed him over.
Another attorney had perfected a method of dealing with that specific type of case. There was one essential witness that the state had to have in every single circumstance. And if they didn't have that, and they couldn't force that essential witness to testify in very specific circumstances. Other times they could. Other times they could be like, no, because of the nature of the case, there's no privilege. We can always force you to testify against the defendant. But me and this one other attorney in my county had scoured the law and found out a way that the state could never force that person to testify if they didn't want to. And without that testimony, the state couldn't make the case, right? So we had gotten into this whole thing of, wait a second, who's the witness? Oh, it's so-and-so. Do they really want to proceed with it? No, they don't. All right, well, have them go talk to this guy. They go talk to this guy, and that guy go, what's your side of the story? And they tell him the side, and he goes, you don't want to testify. Now, well, the way that sounds to me, that was a mutual affray, and realistically, the one of you could be charged. So if you really don't want to testify, you have a Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate yourself unless the DA is willing to grant you full immunity. And the DAs never do that. So every single time we come up, we'd show up, they'd call the case, I'm attorney so-and-so for this person. However, we believe they're calling this witness, and their attorney's here, and that attorney's saying, yes, I'm here for Mr. or Ms. So-and-so, and my client won't be testifying. They have a Fifth Amendment, after consulting with them, I believe that they're at risk of prosecution from their testimony, and they have a Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate themselves. Oh, well, at this stage in the hearing, it can only be hearsay. You know, all we have to do is hearsay, yeah, but there's this case out here that says you can support it to the next stage on hearsay alone if you can provide admissible testimony at the next stage. You're never going to be able to here. You can't force them to waive the Fifth Amendment. So we had gotten that down to an art form. We were becoming known for, we called it the whipsaw. So I'm in court one day.
And then I come along.
Yeah, I'm arguing this. And then the DA goes, well, you know, Your Honor, based on this new case, and I'm sitting there going, what? I'm reading it. And I am tapped out. We've got it out. I'm tapped out. I'm telling him about it later. And he goes, was it this case? I go, yeah. He goes, that was my case.
Plus the appeal made case law. I'll take it.
That's good. That's good. But I also have a serious story. I had a client that came to me. I actually was sitting in the back of a courtroom. Sometimes this happens when you're in a small enough jurisdiction. There was a case going up. There was a person who had been trying to expunge a non-eligible expungement matter for 30 years, and this is something that they weren't able to volunteer with their children's organizations growing up. They had to miss every field trip. They had to miss everything by virtue of the conviction. The only way that we could have, I mean, it's to the point where like even the governor was like, this case is not big enough for me to use my pardon authority on. And the only thing we could think of was using a very little-known common law mechanism called a writ of error quorum nobis. It is the last resort. And I had never handled one. I had another lawyer who has handled them, tried to poach the client away from me. We got that writ of error quorum nobis, and now that person is able to volunteer for their younger child's school activities for the first time in 23 years.
No, that's actually a wonderful outcome. The thing is when we joke about these cases, because I'll have people who will be like, oh, that's heartless. And understand for those of us up here and for most attorneys, it's a job. It's our job. It's how we make a living. It's what we get paid to do. And you hear so many of them day in and day out that at some point you go, it's the job. In my current position, and then have this current position, we have a lot of contact with the general public, and the issues that we handle are issues that do impact people's lives. The people we meet with, the state is impact. Like, we're not putting them in jail, but those decisions that are coming out when we have our trials with them are impacting their lives. And the phrase that I use a lot is, I'm not out to get you, and this agency's not out to get you. But the code says this, and we have to make sure that code's enforced uniformly.
Mine is, I'm not unsympathetic to what you're telling me. I would never want to have to make the decisions you had to make in your situation, but my client has a valid contract, and I got to do my job just like you have to do your job when you go to work.
So,
and then I can only just give my perspective, both as a reporter and as, you know, in government PR. I've taken the aspect of public service really seriously. I just want to try to do good for people. When I was a reporter, like, you know, writing the article that saved the independent bookstore was really meaningful. Exposing the super PACs that were trying to influence the election, which actually led to those super PACs losing their power, was really important. And then just, I mean, now that I'm in PR also, like, when I'm able to take something that we do, there was a resolution to exonerate the victims of the witch hunts of the 1600s. I was able to promote that, and it turned up becoming national news. CNN wrote an article sourcing solely my work, which, I mean, I can get into media criticism as far as I was a reporter, so I took it personally when people would criticize the media. And now I'm in PR working opposite the media, and everyone who was criticizing the media was completely right. But they don't know what I know, so I get very frustrated when they criticize the media, because I'm like, I know what's wrong here. You're just assuming. It's not malice. It's that venture capital has purchased everything and cut it down to the bone. But then now still, I just take public information very seriously. We have a great reputation in my office because instead of partisan things, I imagine people who are already signed up to receive email newsletters don't need that partisan stuff. So I just tell them what's happening in their communities. And it's a really good approach because they trust us. I'm treating people like adults and they respect us in return. So.
All right, next question. Let's let Fur pick somebody.
Oh boy. Orange hat, right there.
It's probably a bit of a cliche question, but what's the best one where the opposing lawyer won the case for you?
That happens all the time. Hi, I do defense law.
Or SK.
SK?
Yeah.
SK. Habs and I both go up against that, and I've got a ask you all a variation of that here in just a second. Habs and I both deal with an attorney that we will know as SK. And SK has gained a bit of a reputation in our office. Like, to the extent that we're like, ah, shit. And it's not because he's hard, and it's not because he's difficult, or he's a real go-getter. It's because, like, ah, shit, we gotta listen to him. He doesn't even know the right principle. And every now and again, he'll do something like, I'm going to call my client to the stand and have them testify as to this. I'm like, why? We weren't going to.
Go right ahead.
And he'll do so. Well, did they ask you this? Yeah. Well, had you been drinking? Well, yeah. Did you drive the car? Yes, I did. But only a few feet, but you drove the car? Yeah. And did they read you that book? Yes. And did you refuse? Yes, I did. But, and we're like, did he just have his guy admit to every single element we need to win the case?
No cross-examination, no, Your Honor.
Yeah, like, and that's it. They're like, would the Commonwealth like to cross-examine? And I know that he's much better than I am, because I'm, my style of law, especially in the courtroom, is much more laid back a lot of times when I'm dealing with the court. But have the Commonwealth has no cross, Your Honor, and sit back down. But he does it with me, like, Mr. Badger, and I'm like, no, I'm good. I think he got him to say everything I wanted him to get him to say. Shit, he got him to say everything I wanted him to. So, and that's kind of frustrating. It's frustrating, though, for another reason, especially on that, which is a lot of the cases that we handle, they can be won, but they're very hard for the other party to win. How do I put it? With those cases, because we handle a lot of different cases. We work for a government agency. We are the trial lawyers for that agency, sometimes the appellate lawyers for that agency. And we handle a lot of cases for that agency. It's not just, you know, we handle a lot of their civil suits if the government needs land. Well, we handle their trials for that. If an employee has been fired and has filed a civil service complaint, about their firing, we handle that. If the government is sued in one of our counties for negligence or a contract, we handle that. We're general trial lawyers. But our everyday, like our bread and butter stuff, we call them, they're not criminal matters, they're criminal adjacent matters. There are some criminal offenses that carry what we call a civil penalty. And the civil penalty could be something like you lose an occupational license that you have as a result of your conviction. You lose your driver's license. You lose a right, like maybe a firearm right or something like that. And those are cases that we handle because the criminal side's done their thing. And so now when somebody says, well, I don't think I should serve out the civil penalty, we'll handle that. And those cases are very difficult to be won. And they're very heavily fact-based, and you have to have a really good lawyer who's very skilled in those areas to overcome that. And SK is not that lawyer. And he knows he's not that lawyer, but he can charge people about $1,500 every time he convinces them he is that type of lawyer. And that's really why we don't like him. Because the other guys that we deal with, and we do, we deal with these guys on a regular basis. The other guys we deal with will tell their client, if I file this, it's only going to delay the civil penalty so you can figure out how to handle it because we're not going to win it. So be aware, you're paying me, you know, $1,500 or $750 or $2,000 to get, you know, 6 months to a year of delay so you can figure out how to handle this. And for some people with the types of penalties we work with, that's worth it. SK goes in, and I know this from personal experience, you know this from personal experience, because we know people that he has told this to, like in our personal, non-professional lives, who got in trouble. He'll go in and he'll say, oh yeah, no, I can take care of it. You pay me, I guarantee you won't serve that out.
What a
and
that is a walking bar complaint.
Yeah. So, I've got a question over here. Fur, you do design for theme parks, right?
Yeah.
Is there any time that somebody has demanded something of you that is amazingly ridiculous that they just set it up for you to really twist the knife on them?
So, I do private clients on a very rare occasion. I usually work through a company that works for another company. I can't tell you the names of those companies, but if you've been to Orlando, you might have an idea. But sometimes I'll take like a private client, and this private client really, really, really wanted like a theme park ride in his house. And I said, well, I don't really do like all the integrate, like actual theme park ride stuff. I just do like the AV integration. I do all that stuff. I can get that all set up for you perfectly fine, but you need to talk to these guys to get the actual ride park on. He wanted to build like this moving like theater inside of his house. And I told him, you've got to get that set up. And like, I'm not sure about the legality of it. Like, you got to get this certified by the Board of Agriculture. They oversee theme park rides.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Yeah. Huh. That's wild.
It's big equipment.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Wow. Because they need to register with the Department of Agriculture.
Right? It's fun. Dude, it's fun when the Department of Ag comes to go do their daily, or they do a yearly inspection, and that basically is they have to ride the ride. They bring their kids.
I know what I want to be when I grow up.
Can I have a log flume?
Right. So a private client comes in and he says, okay, don't ask me how I got it, but I got the entirety of the Disney PhilharMagic ride, like I got the video from that ride, like the original source video. Can you make a ride profile that copies that exactly? I said, I can do it. And he's like, awesome. Oh, by the way, feel free to put this on your portfolio.
I can hear Mickey Mouse rubbing his hands together.
So I go and I finish the ride, I do the profile, and the guy gets, and it takes him about a year and a half to get the agriculture license so he can actually have like a moving theater ride inside of his house. Which was more than enough time for Disney to send him a cease and desist. Because for some reason, Disney checks out my portfolio website. It was the best I told you show because he got the he got the cease and desist, and then 2 days later he got the license to run the ride.
Blue shirt right there.
I actually have one for Alkali.
Uh-oh.
Oh, no.
I have a friend who works in the financial industry.
I'm sorry.
On the banking side of things.
Okay.
But is also an Arctic socialist.
Oh.
So I was wondering, in your experience, how many of these offices are split between the ultra-capitalists and the Arctic socialists trying to undermine the ultra-capitalists and...
I love the question. It exists. It does exist in my industry. I was a commodities broker. Commodities is not like stocks. Stocks, we can all take part in. Stocks, a small piece of a company. Commodities broking is based off of hedging. The idea of what we're doing here, we're not supposed to be playing with this stuff. No one is supposed to be gambling with commodities. They are made as a way for a farmer who is growing a crop to be able to know how much they will sell that crop for when the crop comes to fruition. That was the idea of commodities brokering. But then people got so much money that we realized, oh, we can just buy and sell gold now. And that's what started to happen. So unfortunately for your question specifically to me, very little. Myself and my coworker were the only two liberals in our office. Everyone else was a pretty hardcore conservative and or Nazi.
Back horn.
Backcourt!
Backcourt!
Backcourt! So
didn't work.
I worked in the commodities pit. Corn is one of the things that I literally had to trade when I was a teenager. Pick up the phone on the desk because we were all so busy. And there's a very strange voice that's very recognizable on the other side of that phone, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And they're screaming, "Buy corn! Buy corn! Sir, how much corn should I buy? Is there any left? Then keep buying!" To protect you from the Great Depression, we have a thing called limit breakers. At some point, if a market moves too fast, too quickly, we stop it. That's what happened that day. The market started to go up, the phone rang, picked it up, buy corn, looked up, market hit limit, can't buy corn. Guy screamed at me for 20 minutes, slammed down the phone, whatever. My boss pulls me in later and goes, "Dan, the next time fucking Ross Perot calls you, you can just..."
The best... Only people over a certain age will understand.
The best part of that story for me is, Backcourt! Here's the phone. And then later the phone rang. And what did they say? What did they, like, they're screaming, "Backcourt! Backcourt!" Towards the end of the market day, the phone rang again. What was said?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Didn't work, sell it.
You got the accent, man.
I'm just really proud of the corn.
Oh, yeah.
For coming out and being itself.
To add on, just really quick, because when he was talking about the breaks, the limits, the stock market has those too, by the way. If a stock or even the market itself goes too much in one day, they suspend trading. They say you can't buy or sell this stock anymore. They give it like a little while to cool down, but it's not the full day until it hits the breaks a certain number of times. They're like, suspend it all trading all day. The commodities market has another built-in of protection.
So many.
And my favorite one is called on delivery. When you buy a commodities contract, the idea is like, if I buy my contract at $30, $30 per ton, which is, it's a promise. On this day, I will pay you $30 per ton of grain for 37 tons or something like that, 3,000 tons, whatever. And if you're buying that contract, the idea is if it goes up to, $50, $60 a ton, you get to sell the contract for a profit to somebody else so they can have the right to buy the grain at $30 a ton on that day.
This is what happens when you let rich people gamble in a hedging market.
Right? So there's something called a spot contract in commodities. And a spot contract means you must take delivery of it. If you have that contract on that day, not only do you have to buy the commodity under the contract, you must take delivery of it.
Yeah. You just get this stuff. It's yours now. I'm sure years ago, maybe you heard on the news how people were talking about how oil prices were negative. Who remembers that?
Yeah.
Okay. This is a fast version of what happened there. That was the spot contract. The contract was negative because everybody holding on to one of those who was trying to get out of it, these are hedgers. They don't want, this isn't a barrel of oil. This is tankers of oil for your one contract that you now need to put in your lawn. The market was so negative because storage for the product was in use. We were getting ready to gear up as a country and needed the storage for later. No one could store the oil they bought. Oil prices weren't negative because of oil. Oil prices were negative because, again, rich people got into a market they didn't understand, held on to the contract for too long, and created a bubble, at which time they could not store the product they owned, which means that I watched a ton of rich people get charged a $30,000 a day fee for holding the oil in a tanker that lost so much money.
I had one guy call me when I was in private practice, and they screwed me. I said, "How did they screw you?" And he goes, "Well, I had this thing. It was just, and this dairy just started showing up and dumping milk on my farm." And I go, "What?" And he goes, "Yeah." And I had this contract, and I figured, I said, "Can I see the contract?" And
he sent it over to me.
He sent me over an actual contract because it was like off-market commodities, which he shouldn't have done.
Oh, but, Jesus! Yeah.
And I looked at the contract like, number one, you really need to be having a talk with somebody because they shouldn't do that. Number two, no, there's a delivery clause here. So you didn't resell the contract in a timely manner so they can dump that. Yep. However, there is a commodities exchange you can contact and report this.
There is.
So
that's far.
JT, why don't you pick somebody?
Murray, I believe you're...
Yes. What was the most ridiculous project that you had to take up when you were working at your job?
Why don't I go last? Because mine's only a sentence and you don't want me to go first.
In New York City, I once received a $150,000 contract for the Sex Museum.
I'd like to remind everybody that we are professionals.
With the condition, it was PG-13. It was wonderful.
I told this story last year, but I can tell it again. I inadvertently helped send Pitbull to Alaska. I don't want to fully expose my name, but I am still, I check every 6 months, I am still a listed source on Pitbull's Wikipedia page, Dale Livmos. So basically, in 2012, I was an intern at Reuters news agency in Times Square for about 8 weeks. It was thrilling. It taught me that I didn't want to be a breaking news reporter working on national news. Covering mass shootings was hell, but I will say that I had this afternoon right before the 4th of July where they didn't have anything for me to work on and they told me to do an enterprise story, which is just a reporter who follows their sources and knows their interests, goes out and finds something interesting and drags it back in. So I was a follower of a couple of comedy writers, one of whom had a column for the Boston Phoenix where every week he would take the most ridiculous press pitches that he got from various music artists and companies and labels and he would just mock them mercilessly. So, the summer of 2012, Pitbull teamed up with Sheetz Energy Strips and Walmart. And the Walmart with the most likes on Facebook over the course of an 8 week period would get a free concert from Pitbull. The expectation was that the one in Miami would probably get the most, one of them in Miami, and Pitbull would do a hometown concert and everyone would be happy. This columnist decided to do a search for the most remote Walmart in America. Kodiak, Alaska, community of about 13,000 people, only accessible by seaplane or boat. And he wrote a column about it, and it was getting a little bit of spread here and there, but I was following him, and I was like, you know, this could be something. It could be a fun, like, pop culture human interest story. So I reached out to him, and I put together a story on it, and no one on the edit desk really got it, but I was the intern, so they fought for me, because it was just like, hey, let's throw JT a bone. He's our intern. Let's just do something nice for him over the 4th of July. It was like on the top of Drudge Report the next morning. And 73,000 likes later, Pitbull was exiled to Alaska.
I can tell you Habs and Ives.
I am not exaggerating when I say this. You and I now share a common thread.
What's that?
I worked for an AV integrator in college where we would like make the packages that would get put in the cases and then get sent off to tours.
Okay.
We got hired to send a flight of AV gear to Alaska so Pitbull could do a concert. It's got to fit on a plane.
So, Habs and I actually have the same one because we've had meetings about it this week.
So many meetings.
Yeah, we're not sure we actually have the statutory authority to do that. Yeah, yeah, we agree with you. But the client wants to, so figure it out.
Yeah. We're still trying to figure it out.
There's no figuring it out. Yeah, we did this. Are you legally allowed to do that? Now, you know, let me just walk this through in common. Yeah, we're going to do this, guy. But you can't do that. Yes, we can. Your lawyers should review it. I'm going to ask a judge to say you can't. It comes to us. Yeah, we can't do that. Our client. Make it so we can.
Wow. All I had was someone calling me, asking to pay me money to sue a financial institution for not giving them enough financial aid money.
Okay. You're going to have to throw some context in there a little bit.
The question was, what's like the stupidest thing I've ever been asked to
do? Okay,
I'll ask you later.
After that.
So when I was working as a bankruptcy attorney, there are certain things you can and can't get discharged from bankruptcy, and chief among them is student loans. Who has student loans in the room? Yeah.
Thanks, Biden.
A guy walks into my office, plunks down his flat fee to file a bankruptcy. So that buys full service. Like, we're not going to give you a whole lot of time because we're not getting a whole lot of money for it, but your case should go, in and out, you'll be done. We'll get you out of here. So he pays his flat fee, and he says, I got a case for you guys. It's going to make your names. We're going to take it all the way to the Supreme Court. We're going to get student loans discharged. And I say to him, yeah, you paid me like $800. That's not going to the Supreme Court.
That was always the best one. I got this case. It's got to make you so rich. Yeah, I'm not going to take it on contingency. Well, I don't want to pay you that much an hour. Why? You're going to be rich when we win.
That's funny.
That seems to me like you ask me to take a risk you're not willing to take, sir.
That's really clever.
Oh, that's like the, I'll do it for exposure in my business.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Hey,
come on,
I
was like, get your name out there.
Yeah,
I've had that one.
Oh, man.
Do you know how many people ask me to take their divorce cases pro bono?
Really?
Yes.
Well, listen, the first county I practiced law in, I used to say you could have a lot of clients in that county as long as you don't expect to get paid.
Yep. All right. I told you where I work, commodities broking, the people who were there. I was one of the youngest people there. I have been a commodities broker in the Pit since I was 16 years old. I started as a runner. I moved to the Pit. I moved up to an office eventually. And the last job I did was with a small group. There was only six of us, but we basically ran our own thing for a bigger company, which also meant we needed to meet with new clients. And that was a team. That was me and Andrew. I was the face. I could talk. I could have them have a good time. I could get them the drugs, and I could get them the hookers. That was my job. Andrew was the rich boy. Andrew came from money and could speak their language, and between the two of us, that's what we did. One day, my boss pulls me off to the side and says, we got one for you guys. And they just told us where they want to go, so I'm going to need you to organize this. And that was the day I took my coworker Andrew and our new client to Steamworks. And nothing is better than taking your ultra-conservative coworker who is trying to schmooze his brand new gay client at a gay bathhouse while I'm just handing out weed. I've just got there. I'm sitting there like fat Santa Claus in the sauna. Like, everyone, you've got to have a good time because we need to impress that guy over there. Here you go, buddies. Poppers, weed. And Andrew, my ultra-conservative co-worker, with me in nothing but a towel, cowering in the corner, who is now looking to me for protection. I succeeded. Don't worry. When a gentleman boozy size came up to the two of us, looked at me, looked at him, said, "Hey, sweetheart." I go, "That's my bitch."
I'd like to imagine that you all landed the client at Steamworks, and the client walked over to Andrew and said, "You know what? You're my guy. Let's shake on." Andrew stuck his hands like,
No. The worst part was the guy was super respectful. He was just like a normal rich dude. He was like, "No, I've always wanted to do Steamworks. You guys said you have a gay guy that's going to be with me. Let's do that." And Andrew's like, "No!" And I was like, "Yes!"
"You all got a broke rich gay? Good, let's go."
The worst part is all my coworkers were like, "Bring your cell phone and get pictures of Andrew." And they're like, "Guys, this is a gay bathhouse. We're not going to take it ourselves." I'm like, "Just pay them off and take." So now they're doing a collection. Like, they want me to buy spy equipment.
Where would you put the camera?
We all know where I'm going to put the camera. Did you film this out of a tunnel? Yes.
Well, buddy, would you like to picture our next question, please?
I told you not to let me do that.
I think you in the back, you've had your hand up for a while. Sweet.
First of all, the reporter. So, I know that a lot of stuff looks for the media. How have you ever done like stuff with that? And like, how is it, like, how do you kind of set the record straight on that, where like people are, you know, like the pop goes in, like, "Oh, it's all people sending this." Have you ever had like stuff where you were either approached to do something on the, on like the culture?
I actually have not had furry cross through my professional paths very much until I started coming to AnthroCon, and instead of coming up with really intricate excuses as to why I was in Pittsburgh and just so happened to be around and in all of these photos with furries, my coworkers are aware, and it seems like they don't really care, but they don't really mind either. I unfortunately only worked in a national capacity in the media for a very limited time. I was working at a local, like a regional newspaper. So unfortunately, only once or twice did furry reach a point where I could potentially write about it, and there was never really an opportunity to do so, unfortunately.
I mean, I refuse to hide it. Yeah. I absolutely refused. I was miserable where I was, so I had a little Alkali badge behind my monitor that I could look at. And that all culminated when John the Human, if you've ever been to First Square, yeah, thank you. So, a good friend of mine, he basically, I've been working with him for years. He came and was my financial director for First Square for its first 2 years. And at the charity show, there's a certain person who loves to Photoshop my face onto things. John won it. I was fired this year. To this day, everyone in the office refuses to take down the poster of my face on the cover of GQ magazine with a bunch of furry stuff on the side that looks right into the door of the manager's office, who's the one who decided to fire me. I hate those guys, but there's times when I love them.
If I can just add on briefly, I have an answer to the question that's slightly different. So, like I said, furry only comes into my professional capacity when I drag it in, and I try to limit it just because I'm sure the eighth picture of a giant wolf running around Pittsburgh when all of my other coworkers are, you know, taking care of their kids and, you know, that it's just, there's limited value to it. But I joined the fandom and started coming to cons in 2018, and pre-2018 in a professional capacity, I was finding my opportunities were very limited, and it was partially because I was skittish and anxious and scared a lot of the time. I wasn't willing to take on big opportunities or big responsibilities because I was worried I wasn't going to be able to take them. And going to cons started correlating with me associating with the positive traits of my persona in my daily life. And actually, I basically pretended to be my persona and effectively faked it until I made it. My persona was an idealized version of myself, and gradually that idealized version just became my day-to-day version. You know, coming out to Pittsburgh by myself or with a couple of friends for the first time, driving 8 hours and getting lost in a sea of furries, really gave me the confidence to start taking the bull by the horns at work, so to speak, because if I was doing stuff like that, I can take on responsibilities in you know, state government. I can jump out and do more things. So in that capacity, furry has really made me a better professional because it's expanded my horizons and made me more open to opportunities and experiences I normally wouldn't have taken.
From a legal perspective, nobody gives a shit what we do in our off time. You don't hire us because you care whether we're giant animal people. You hire us because you have an issue, and as long as we can address that issue and do so in a professional manner, it's been my experience, our clients don't care. Now, within the industry, do other lawyers care?
Yes, we're petty.
Yeah. Actually, when I fell into the furry fandom, I remember going to a bar association dinner and hearing somebody at the table behind me go, "Have you heard about this badger motherfucker?" And I'm
like, "Great thing."
No, but I hear he's extremely handsome.
Got a giant schwanz. I just identified every Pennsylvania Dutch person in the room with one word. I love that. So, yeah, does that matter? No, not really. And as for, like, coworkers, like, I had one lawyer be like, "You go to furry conventions." I'm like, "You have a mistress and a coke habit." And, like, that stay, like, we joke in the area that I've practiced in, the joke was, if you're a lawyer in this area, you can have one mistress and one drug habit. Any more than that, you're getting greedy. I just want to be a badger. So it doesn't really matter. No, not a lot. Do I bring it up? No. And it has really done either. We don't bring it up around the office. It has no impact. When I was on my way here, Hap sent me a message, because we're assisting. We have a deputy chief counsel, an assistant chief counsel over our entire office. And Hap said, "Did you tell the assistant chief you were going to Pittsburgh?" And I'm like, "No." He's like, "Okay," because I did, and they asked why. And I'm like, "Yeah, no, they don't need to know where the fuck I'm going. It's my vacation time. It doesn't come up. That's not going to impact my job."
She was just trying to be friendly.
Yeah, no, very friendly. Like, where are you going on vacation? A place. What are you going to do? Things. Why don't you bring it up? I don't know. You didn't tell me about your bridge game last week, so why am I telling you about my house? So,
where are you going? Pittsburgh. What are you doing? Seeing friends.
Yeah. Yeah, now somebody brought it up, like, "Are you the furry lawyer?" Yeah, I'm one of them.
It's come up in a professional capacity for me, like, incidentally a couple of times. Now, when I was at this medical practice, small town Georgia, medical practice, most people are, like, pretty conservative. And they're like, "Now, I don't want to speak out of turn, but I think this guy in my office is gay." So somebody comes into my office, like, we've been talking for a little while, I'm trying to make friends, you know. Nobody wants to talk to me because I'm their lawyer, and if they're talking to me, it's because something's gone tits up. So I am desperately trying to make friends at this job. So this one lady comes to my office. We're going to talk about movies, books, that kind of thing. She closes the door and says, "Hey, listen, I just wanted to tell you that I read Werewolf Erotica."
Were you like, "Me too"?
So I, now, I was at the Writing King panel at midnight last night. You're all liars. Yeah, so I looked at her and said, "You know, that's not the weirdest thing I've ever heard today."
Nice. To kind of explain that, and especially, time to be an old man. Especially if you're a younger part of the fandom and you're like, "Oh, furry cringe, I don't want people knowing about that, it's a hobby and it'll be embarrassing, da 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 da." And I grew up gay in the late 80s and 90s. Well, queer, I guess I should say. Yeah. Bye. However, yeah. I like to do things with things that have the same things I have, as well as things that have things other than what I have. In the South, and there's a point to this. I'm not like, we're going to have a talk about my sex life. There's a point to this. That was a period of time where you could, and you did, and I did at one point, get the shit beat out of you if people had that impression. And you know what? You get your nose broken a few times, and you break a few people's noses a few times, and you really stop giving a shit. I grew up with older folks in the community who would say, "Oh, yeah, no." And I'm like, you know, they talk about these people when, like, we go places. And they'd be like, "Oh, yeah, my buddy this and my buddy that." And we used to this. I'm like, "Where are they?" They're like, "They're dead." What? They're dead. How they die? AIDS.
Yeah.
So somebody doesn't like me for being a badger or thinks that's what, okay, motherfucker, I'll break your nose. You broke mine, but you know, better idea. Let's just not say shit to each other, okay? You don't give a shit what people say about your hobbies at that point. It doesn't matter. It's not a big deal.
I found, for me, it's just time and place. Like, I'm not bringing furry in. Like, with maybe an exception that I have Louis sitting on my desk staring in judgment of all my fuckhead clients. I don't bring it into work. There's no need for it to come into work. And if it ever becomes situationally appropriate, like when I was in a car wreck, it will be shared. That was a fun moment. My boss loves golden retrievers.
You too, huh?
See, I mean, by the way, the only there's one person in my law office that knows, and it's only because he had to. I was in a car wreck earlier this year. Someone ran a red light. His intake form for all clients includes a social media disclosure. If you don't know why we make you disclose our social media to us, I don't know what to tell you, because we are going to Google you one way or the other to make sure you're not screwing over your own case. So that was a very quiet, "Hey, can I close the door?" And just like Boozy said, it was one of those, "I don't care what you do in your time, you don't care what I do on my time, don't bring it in the office."
Yeah, and that's really the rule of thumb, is you can't let it impact your work as long as you don't. Nobody cares. Nobody cares.
When you work for a multi-million dollar media conglomerate who makes a lot of things that a lot of people here really like to draw porn of, it gets a little bit blurred.
Look, I have two other lawyers in my practice, and I'm the compliance department.
I kept a really good separation up until I got fired from my previous job. So if you don't know the story, really quickly, my previous job fired me, and then 2 weeks later, they accepted my interview request for a new role. And if you know the mustache gate story, I'm not going to rehash it, but basically, long story short, that went stupid viral on Twitter, and I'm making fun of my old place, and the problem is that crossed into human Twitter. And then that crossed into recruiter Twitter. Then that crossed into my new jobs Twitter. They were super respectful. No one ever said anything. I got hired at my new place. And it was weird. I got hired on Tuesday, then I went to MFF. My boss, who was actually in the UK, like I work for a company in the UK, came out over the weekend while I was gone. You know, couldn't meet to say hello, but he did leave a note on my desk. He said, "Will, we're proud to have you on the team. We've heard so many good things about you. You're going to do great here. Welcome to the team. If you need anything, reach out." Next to that note was a plush skunk.
Last question. Hams, why don't you pick it?
You in the brown shirt, I've seen your hand up many, many times. Yeah, right there.
Okay, so anyone, I know you might not be familiar with a little bit, but
you're going to have to speak up just a little. I can't hear you on my end.
Oh. You want to come up and use a microphone? Come on up.
Yeah.
So, is any one of y'all familiar with the movie Glengarry Ross?
Mm-hmm.
What's the, because I know it was a really bleak movie about, like, a sales, you know, being as a sales worker.
Wait, that was bleak? I thought it was a comedy.
I thought so, too. Shit got kind of got dark.
Third place, you're fired.
Especially with Alec Baldwin. And what's probably one of the craziest topics that's probably similar to the movie? At one of your jobs, especially you, Alkali.
I got one.
Oh, go for it.
So, I was working for a government contractor at the time. They were desperately trying to get staffing gigs working for Trump's administration. And, you know, my heart wasn't in it for some reason. And, so my boss decides to, the CEO of the company decides to fly to his vacation home in Puerto Rico, but he did make sure that the vice president of my department came back from her enforced sabbatical for exhaustion, which she was hospitalized for, to come threaten all of us and say, "Listen, you're going to double down here. If you are not willing to work twice as hard, twice as many hours, then you might as well turn your resignations now. I'll be accepting them immediately." So I did. Nice. And then I got on a plane and went to Camp Tiny Paws.
This would be an
RPK in Camp Tiny Paws.
Yes, that's how we
but,
do it.
But Glenn Ross, the Alec Baldwin character's consultant, sent in to boost sales and tell them what horrible salesmen they are. And one of the lines is, "Put that coffee down. Coffee's for closers." Making coffee a reward for performing your job. We have a coffee machine in our office. And every now and again, one of us will go, "Coffee's for closers."
All right. So, it wasn't a consultant. Anyone who's in any kind of corporate environment, you have to do that training, right? What's the training you got to do? You got to do the training for your job. I know you guys have to take like a yearly thing that's actually made.
Oh, not only that, but as part of the agency, we have regular trainings we have to do, like our active shooter training.
Yes.
And by the way, I just want to let you know the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania stole its active shooter training from the city of Houston, Texas. And they even left the copyright on it. It's
that's amazing. So that's a really common thing. And when you get into commodities trading, this is so constant. Anytime there's a rule change, we have to do a little thing and show that we acknowledge it. And then, of course, the normal corporate stuff. So no one pays any attention to what you're going to anymore. No one knows. It's just, "Hey, during your shift, 5 o'clock, you need to go downstairs training." Got it? No one knew this was company-wide sexual harassment training day. Okay. No one knew. This guy came in and he was not ready. Because I work in a locker room. That is what commodities trading is. These are a bunch of rich people who have been skating through life. It was like working in a high school locker room. Our HR department got moved from our building because they were too close to us and they could hear what was going on. So instead of fixing the problem, we bought a